I've been asking the folks in New Mexico to pay attention to the teaching and reading I've been doing on the UFO crash site, or so alleged, near Roswell, New Mexico. I keep hoping, since we're in New Mexico, that I will hear from some of them there that I have personal or eyewitness experience with these events. Now, I've been reading the book UFO Crash at Roswell by Kevin Randall and Donald Smith. Major Jesse Marcel. The book has pictures of him with the so-called balloon wreckage that became the cover story for the crash. He's showing the remains of the weather balloon in General Ramey's office. The record here says he later told friends that the real wreckage had been removed and the balloon substituted. There's a picture of General Ramey in his office with the remains of the weather balloon. Photo courtesy of Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And a comment, there's no doubt that Ramey had the real debris switched, and what was photographed was a Rowan target device. In May 1990, the writers of this book had located Major Jesse Marcel near Missoula, Montana. They had a hypnotist with them. As they continued to pursue this story, having heard that Major Marcel had said to friends that it wasn't a weather balloon, in spite of, while in his army tenure, supporting the weather balloon story, with everything in place, Smith and Randall left for Montana. When they arrived in Missoula, they met with Watkins. You'll know more about him. He told them more about his background, including his work on the Hillside Strangler case of Los Angeles, fear and fame. If nothing else, Watkins was used to controversy. Watkins made it clear that he had spent years as a psychologist. He worked in VA hospitals treating soldiers for mental disorders stemming from their combat experiences. He is a psychology professor emeritus at the University of Montana. Turn me down just a little. I sound like I'm in a barrel in here. Watkins is the author of 6 books, over 90 papers, more than 100 articles on various aspects of his research and hypnosis. So from Missoula, they drove to Jesse. You want me to keep pursuing this as we have time? From Missoula, they drove to Jesse Marcel's home. While Watkins talked to Jesse Marcel, Smith and Randall interviewed his mother. They wanted to learn what her impressions were when Major Marcel brought home some of the material recovered on the crash site. She said that Jesse Sr. was excited about it. He thought that it was something extraordinary, and of course she didn't know what it could be. They had spread it out in the kitchen to examine it. Her descriptions of it matched those given by the others who had handled it. The afternoon sessions produced the best results with Jesse Marcel Jr. Neither Smith nor Randall expected anything spectacular. They hoped to learn in greater detail what had happened during the early morning examination of the debris by the Marcel family. Watkins worked with Marcel for nearly an hour, getting him to relax and finally into a light trance. Watkins had Marcel relive a few childhood memories, moving him from an early part of his life in Houston to Roswell, New Mexico. Slowly, Watkins brought Marcel, under hypnosis, forward until it was the end of the July 4th, 1947 weekend. Watkins, trying not to lead Marcel, suggested that something important was happening, that his father was there, excited about something. Now, we're talking to Jesse Marcel, Jr. Watkins asked, "What is happening?" It was now as if Jesse Marcel, Jr. was being shaken from a sound sleep by his father in 1947. He was slightly confused because his father was standing over him trying to get him to wake up. Marcel followed his father outside to help carry in a box filled with debris. Jesse Jr. mentioned that his father had not driven a staff car out to the Brazel Ranch, but took their Buick convertible. Back inside the house, they spread the debris. Now, I skipped over the transition from Jesse Marcel, his position in the Army, their search. And if you're watching tonight for the first time, I've been reading from this book and others for several days, maybe even weeks now. Now they are examining the memory track under hypnosis of Jesse Jr. Back inside the house, as he relates it under hypnosis, they spread the debris over the kitchen floor, trying to fit the pieces together like a giant jigsaw puzzle, but the damage was too great. Nothing fit together. Smith leaned forward then and quietly asked, "How much of the floor was covered?" Marcel spoke slowly, quietly, as if examining it before he could answer the question. "It filled most of the kitchen floor, from the back door to the door that led into the living room. It was spread from the stove on the left across the floor to the sink and refrigerator." Marcel described some small, black, plastic-like material that was thicker than lead foil and that was much stronger. He said it looked like Bakelite. He also mentioned the lead foil and the I-beams. Watkins asked what was happening. Jesse Jr. said that his father was crouched near the back door trying to fit some of the pieces together, but they wouldn't fit. There was too much of it, and the damage had been too great. While Marcel and his son were trying to put together the debris, Marcel's wife picked up one of the I-beams and said, "There's writing on this." Jesse Jr. looked at one of the I-beams, noticed writing on it too. Under hypnosis, he said, "I can't read it." He hesitated and added, "Purple. Strange. Never saw anything like it." Randall asked him what the writing looked like. "Different geometric shapes, leaves, circles." Under hypnosis, Marcel drew the symbols as they appeared on the I-beam. Under questioning, Marcel said that the symbols were a shiny purple, that they were small, less than fingernail wide. There were many separate figures. He also described the beam. He said that it was broken at both ends, that it was made of the same material as the lead foil, and that it was cold to the touch. It was thicker and tougher than the lead. He could not bend it. While Marcel was still under hypnosis, Smith asked Jesse what his father was saying. "It's a flying saucer." "Is he using those words?" "Yes." I asked him what a flying saucer is. "I don't know what a flying saucer is." "What did he say?" "It's a ship. He's excited." Smith asked, "Does he say anything about a balloon?" "No. Only flying saucer." Marcel then described how he assisted his father putting the debris back in a large cardboard box. They carried it out and put it in the trunk of the Buick. Smith asked, "When is the next time you see him?" Answer, "The next day after work." "What day?" "Wednesday. I'm not in school. Don't keep track of the days." Marcel then said that his father didn't say anything about the flying saucer. In fact, Major Marcel cautioned his family about mentioning it at all. Major Marcel told him not to talk about it, to forget it. With Jesse Jr. still under hypnosis, Smith asked him when the next time his father mentioned the crash was. Jesse Jr. said that he was in high school and that his father still didn't know what it was. Marcel Sr. said, however, that it wasn't a balloon. It was not a radar target. Under more detailed questioning, Marcel remembered a few other details. His father told him that there had been a lot of debris on the ranch and that soldiers had been sent out to guard the field. The problem was that Jesse Jr. was only 11 years old. His father talked to his wife, but Jesse Jr. was more of an observer to those discussions and not a participant. In fact, when Smith and Randall tried to learn more about what Marcel said on the day of his return, Jesse Jr. told them that his parents were in the kitchen. He was waiting for his friend to come over. That was the end of the session. Both Smith and Randall agreed it had been valuable. If nothing else, they'd learned a few more details and gotten a drawing out of the symbols Marcel had seen on the I-beam. Smith conducted the final interview during the Montana trip. He visited with Robert Porter, hoping to learn a few new things about the first flight out of Roswell. According to Porter, the flight was authorized by Major Ralph R. Taylor. The material, the triangle-shaped package and the three or four shoeboxes, were brought to the aircraft by a staff car. Porter was sure that the material had been stored in Building 1034, which was labeled as an engineering building on the base map. Peter, go get that handheld. I want to show you some pictures. The point of this much reading is that too many witnesses, too many reports to be coincidence, something happened at Roswell that the government tried to cover up. That's very apparent. And then we come to July 1990, but before that, the pictures. Here's Major Jesse Marcel with the balloon wreckage. The cover story. Not the first story that had been released or out. There's Major Marcel with another picture of the balloon. General Ramey in his office, whom this article says is the person who had the real debris switched and then had the weather balloon photographed for the cover story. General Ramey and his chief of staff inspecting the remains of the weather balloon. July 1990. Well, I can show that. These are drawings by Glenn Dennis, formerly a mortician at Roswell in 1947. These illustrations are based on the actual drawings done in Mr. Dennis' presence by the nurse who participated in the preliminary autopsies at Roswell one day later. Five bodies claiming to have been found. Want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Get on telephone. We have joined additional people as we do every half hour, and I've been reading from the UFO crash at Roswell, New Mexico, by Kevin Randall and Donald R. Smith. They have been researching this for years. I have read it random through the book. The gestalt I hope to leap out of the book is that there are just too many witnesses, too many reports, too many cross-checkings, too much evidence of an attempt by the government to suppress the story and a government cover-up to conclude anything other than something very strange happened near Roswell, New Mexico. Not a weather balloon crash. Some strange unidentified vehicle. There are multiplied claims of bodies at the site, quickly taken by the government. and a cover-up. Now, this is maybe in a little book the most complete study of the Roswell situation. They followed lead after lead. Each person they would research and interview would suggest someone else, and they would chase all the leads down. And that's what we're still doing on television in New Mexico. I'm hoping there'll be people call me that know of some of these events, haven't had reason, in some cases courage, because of government pressure to speak out. I'd like to hear from you. If you don't want me to read your message or reveal your name, say so. I'll protect your confidentiality. But I have the hope that as we cover New Mexico and I raise this issue that's been a mystery since 1947, one of many such mysteries in the UFO scenario, I'll get some response out of New Mexico. At the same time, it's Monday night early in the week, and we are expecting our regulars to call until the 3,000 quota is made up. Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on Channel 2. There was an article in the Albuquerque Journal about 2 weeks ago. If you could find a copy and send it to me, anybody, I'd very much appreciate it. It gave a nutshell summary of the incident with photographs of a sketch of the alien. Also, I think it was on October 28th, there was a news article in Mountain Air Rainbow. The article stated that UFOs were buzzing residents in the area, that is, hovering approximately 100 feet overhead, nearby the Manzano Mountains. Last night, there was supposed to be another incident, a sighting of UFOs overhead in that area again. Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm checking in to tell you I'm watching. Channel 2. I know everything about this incident because I grew up around these people. The debris was found in Roswell, but the ship went down in St. Augustine, about 150 miles away. There were five bodies. You're right. It was not a weather balloon. After all of their research in this book, The UFO Crash at Roswell, Kevin Randall and Donald Smith, you may say, why are you reading this? Well, because I like to pursue truth, open minds. But maybe as much as anything, prove that a Christian spokesperson is not afraid of this. The Bible's full of UFOs. A fundamentalist is going to have trouble figuring out how to explain UFOs. I don't have any trouble believing there's life on other planets. I believe heaven's out there somewhere. My congregation have an open mind, not a closed mind. And they have cataloged the sequence of events from all of their research, chasing down every lead up to the date of this publication, as well as anyone, anywhere. Wednesday, July 2nd, 1947, a timeline for the whole Roswell incident. 9:50 p.m., Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot reported an oval-shaped object, like two inverted saucers facing mouth-to-mouth, moving at a high rate of speed. Flew over their house in Roswell, New Mexico. The object was heading to the northwest. This is the summary timeline of all the interviews, of which I only picked a little bit. During a thunderstorm in the Corona, New Mexico area, W.W. Mac Brazel heard a tremendous thunderclap. It sounded like an explosion, but that was somehow different than the rest of the thunder. Others in the area reported the same phenomenon. William Woody reported that he and his father watched a bright meteor described as white with a red tail streak across the sky, falling to the horizon. Thursday, July 3rd, 1947. Because of the rain the night before, Brazel inspected the pastures. July and August are the rainy months, and Brazel planned to move the livestock onto the fields that had received the rain. During the inspection, he discovered a large debris field. Scattered on the slopes and into the sinkholes and depressions was metal. Plastic-like beams, pieces of lightweight material, foil and string. The debris was thick enough that the sheep refused to cross the field and had to be driven around it to water more than a mile away. Brazel, taking a few scraps of the material, headed to the home of his closest neighbors, Floyd and Loretta Proctor. He showed them a little sliver of material that refused to burn and couldn't be cut. The Proctors suggested that he take it into town to show the sheriff. Loretta Proctor also remembered the rewards being offered for proof of the flying disc's reality and thought that Max should try to claim the money. Later that evening, Brazel removed the large circular piece of the debris from the range. According to Bill Brazel, his father either loaded it into the back of his truck or dragged it along behind. He stored it in a livestock shed about 3 miles north of the crash site. You picture that, Peter, that livestock shed. There it is. Saturday, after storing it, July 5th, 1947. I had just graduated from high school. God, that's a long time ago. Military bases along the West Coast had fighters on standby in case the flying discs were seen. A few of the bases in Oregon and Washington had planes equipped with gun cameras on airborne alert because of a rash of UFO sighting reports. Sherman Campbell of Circleville, Ohio, reported to the sheriff that he thought he had an explanation for some of the flying disc sightings. He had found a weather balloon on his farm. It was metallic, with a kite-like appendage on it. Under the right conditions, as it drifted on the upper atmosphere winds, it could look like a flying disc. The device was on display at the local newspaper office and then returned to Campbell. Jean Campbell Romero, Campbell's daughter, reported that it had been kept in the barn for years afterward. Sunday, July 6, 1947. Brazel got up early, as was his habit, completed his chores, and then drove into Roswell about 75 miles away. He stopped at the office of Sheriff George A. Wilcox. Contrary to published reports, Wilcox was excited about the find and suggested they call the military. While they were waiting for the military officers to arrive, Wilcox dispatched two deputies to the ranch. They had only the directions given by Brazel, but both men were familiar with the territory, and Wilcox thought they'd be able to find the debris field that Brazel described. Frank Joyce, on that same day, Sunday, July 6, 1947, a reporter and announcer for radio station KGFL, said that he called the sheriff and asked if there's anything interesting happening at the office. According to Joyce, Wilcox told him there was someone there he should interview. Joyce talked to Brazel, but said he didn't pay much attention to what Brazel was saying. He was busy trying to run the station, get the records changed, and listen to the story that Brazel was telling. Colonel William Blanchard, commander of the 509th Bomb Group, Major Jesse A. Marcel, the air intelligence officer, and a man in civilian clothes, a counterintelligence agent, responded to the sheriff's call. According to Phyllis McGuire, daughter of the sheriff, the military arrived almost as soon as the sheriff had hung up the phone. The officers interviewed Brazell, examined some pieces of the material, and then Blanchard ordered Marcel and the counterintelligence man to accompany Brazell to the ranch. Blanchard, sure that he was in possession of something unusual, alerted the next higher headquarters. According to Blanchard's first wife, Ethel, this is the timeline, results of all their interviews. He thought that they might have found something that belonged to the Soviets. No one mentioned any type of balloon. Blanchard, acting on orders from General Clements McMullen, passed to him by Colonel Thomas Dubose, sealed in a bag, some of the material Brazell had brought to the sheriff's office. The material was then flown on to the Fort Worth Army Airfield. After the military officers left, along with Brazell, the two deputies, sheriff's deputies, returned. They hadn't found the debris field, but they did find a burned area in one of the pastures. The sand had been turned to glass and blackened. Remember, I told you once how the dangling wires of an antenna of a powerful shortwave station makes what they call glass eggs, as the dust turns to glass. It looked as if something circular had touched down. The weather balloons don't have that capacity. The aircraft from Roswell was met at the Fort Worth Army Air Force Base, or airfield, by Dubose and Colonel Allen D. Clark. Clark received the plastic bag with the debris and walked to the command B-26 to fly it on to Washington, D.C., and General McMullen. Because it was so far out to the ranch over roads that were less than adequate, Brazell, Marcel, and the CIC agent didn't arrive until after dark. They stayed at the ranch house, ate cold beans and crackers, and waited for daylight. Marcel used a Geiger counter on the large piece of wreckage that Brazell had stored in the cattle shed. He detected no sign of radiation. Monday. July 7th. Brazell took the two military officers out to the crash site. According to Marcel, the debris field was 3/4 of a mile long, 200 to 300 feet wide. There was a gouge starting at the northern end of it that extended for 400 or 500 feet toward the other end. Bill Brazell said that it looked as if something had touched down and skipped along. The largest piece of debris was found at the southern edge of the gouge. Marcel described the debris as being as thin as newsprint, but so strong he couldn't bend it. There was foil that, when crumbled, would unfold itself without a sign of a wrinkle. There were I-beams that would flex slightly and that had some sort of writing or symbols on them. The description of the debris was confirmed by Bill Brazell, Loretta Proctor, Tommy Tyree, Walt Whitmore, Sr., Jesse Marcel, Jr., Ms. Viaud Marcel, Robert Shirky, Robert Smith, O.W. Henderson, and Lewis S. Rickett. Again, this timeline, the result of a book full of interviews. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Marcel and the CI agent walked the perimeter of the field, then ranged out looking for more debris or another crash site, but found nothing. Finally, they returned and spent the remainder of the day collecting the debris they could. They loaded the rear of Marcel's 42 Buick and then the Jeep carry-all driven by the CIC man. About dusk, they left the field for Roswell. Lieutenant General Nathan F. Twining, The commander of the Air Material Command, the parent organization at Wright Field, Ohio, changed his plans suddenly on that Monday and flew into the Alamogordo Army Airfield, later Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico. Twining was just a short drive from the Roswell Army Airfield. Tuesday, July 8, 1947, 2 a.m. Marcel, excited by the find, stopped at his house on the way to the base. He awakened his wife and son to show them the material. They spent an hour examining it, scattered it on the kitchen floor. Marcel was not breaking regulations since nothing he brought in had yet been classified. Marcel then collected it all, loaded it into the car, and drove to the base. 6 a.m. Marcel, the counterintelligence agent, visited with Blanchard in his quarters, telling him what they had seen. In later years, Marcel would insist that they knew the moment they saw the debris field that the crash was of something that had not been manufactured on Earth. Blanchard called the provost marshal, identified in the 509th unit history as Major Edwin Easley. Blanchard ordered Easley to post guards on the roads around the crash site, denying access to anyone without official business. He ordered Easley to find Brazell and have him escort the MPs to the crash site. Blanchard also called 8th Air Force Headquarters and advised them that Marcel had returned with more of the debris. By this time, Blanchard and Marcel knew that it was not a Russian device. 8th Air Force Headquarters in Fort Worth relayed Blanchard's message up the chain of command, alerting the Pentagon about the strange material. A special flight from Andrews was arranged for men coming from the Pentagon. 7:30 a.m. The regular morning staff meeting had been moved up. Blanchard discussed what they had found and what they should do about it. Attending that meeting were Marcel, the counterintelligence man, Lewis S. Rickett, Lieutenant Colonel James I. Hopkins, the operations officer, Major Patrick Saunders, the base adjutant, Major Isidore Brown, the personnel officer, and Lieutenant Colonel Ulysses S. Nero, the supply officer. There is no reason to believe the Colonel or Lieutenant Colonel Charles W. Horton, Lieutenant Colonel Fernand L. Andry, and Lieutenant Walter Hout, the public information officer, were also in attendance. During the meeting, they decided how to handle the retrieval and who would be accomplishing which tasks. 9 a.m. The counterintelligence agent and his assistant drew a staff car and drove to the crash site. Following them was another contingent of MPs. They were stopped by the guards that had been posted earlier. When they arrived, they saw that MPs had already been stationed around the debris field to protect it. Blanchard and members of his staff were on the phones conferring with higher headquarters. Marcel and some of the wreckage were ordered to Fort Worth so that Brigadier General Roger Ramey could inspect it. 11 a.m. Walter Hout finished the press release and was preparing to take it into town. The first paragraph said, quote, "The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday." He took it first to one of the radio stations. By noon, he'd given a copy of the release to both radio stations and to both daily newspapers. The counterintelligence men at the ranch checked the ground again. The guards were posted around the gouge, around the debris field, and finally on the hills surrounding the area. The counterintelligence men located Mac Brazell and took him back to Roswell. Every point of contact in Roswell reported that they were swamped by calls. Sheriff Wilcox reported calls from Europe and Asia. Art McQuitty, editor of the Roswell Morning Dispatch, said that from the moment the press release hit the wire, he was on the phone. Walter Hout said the same thing. The world was trying to learn what happened in Roswell. The first of the special flights from Washington arrived. On the plane was Warrant Officer Robert Thomas. Thomas and the men were in uniform upon arrival, but quickly changed to civilian clothes. These men would remain at Roswell throughout the retrieval. The phones at the bases started to ring. Blanchard, irritated because he couldn't get a phone line, ordered Hout to do something about all the incoming calls. Hout said there was nothing they could do about the incoming calls. Sheriff Wilcox, wondering what happened out at the crash site, sent two more deputies out. This time they ran into the cordon thrown up by the Army and were turned back. The Army was letting no unauthorized personnel onto the crash site. Mid-afternoon, Brazell was flown back toward the ranch. His was not the first flight back at the 500, back as the 509th tried to find the flight crew of the craft. They were all sure that there had to be one. The second crash site was located, and men on the ground were directed toward it. Brazell, because he knew the land well, was helping to direct them in toward the second site. Before the Army could arrive, if you want me to continue, you get on telephone. I'm sure most of you figured out that those were the buses in an earlier film sequence in the previous song. Those were pictures of the buses arriving at the Cathedral Sunday, Anniversary Sunday, and the first look of many of those who got off the bus, of that towering crane with that part of one of the Jesus Save signs that we expect to be installed by next Sunday, hanging up in the sky above the cathedral on the back side. They were entering the parking lot in the back. And I'm sure you could witness their joy. It's been a long, hard fight. We did not move downtown to make a financial investment. All the other Protestant churches fled the downtown, as the LA Times said, because of mounting expenses and dwindling congregation. We went downtown expecting to spend to make sure that the testimony of faith in God that's been a part of the City of the Angels for so many years was preserved by someone. And these Jesus Save signs are historic monuments in the city of Los Angeles, now wed to the historic monument, our cathedral. And it is a great time of rejoicing, and you can see it on the faces of the people. I'm sure they'll run some of it again tonight, but right now I'm reading on the UFO incident in Roswell, New Mexico. But not unless you keep calling and checking in. I still have to find 3,000 each week who call and say, I've been taught, and because of the teaching, I want to be one of the 3,000 that you can count on this week. Somebody asked, is Jesus Save sign going to be lit at night? The answer is yes. They've been a presence in Los Angeles for many years. They're now restored, going up on the top of the cathedral. And if you look closely last Sunday, even that partial sign that we had hanging in the air was lighted. So yes, they will be lighted. Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Or Girardeau, whichever it is. I'm picking you up on 1610 AM. On my car radio, I'm almost 100 to 150 miles south of St. Louis. And I'm picking up the signal loud and clear. I'm driving north from Memphis and have been listening all night long. This is great. That's 1610 AM. Back to UFO crash at Roswell. by Kevin Randall and Stephen Smith. And after a book full of interviews and tracing this mystery, they've constructed a timeline. A second crash site was located shortly after noon on Tuesday, July 8, 1947, the first find occurring, the first site on the 4th of July weekend. The second crash site was located and men on the ground were directed toward it. Brazel, because he knew the land well, was helping to direct them in toward the second site. Before the army could arrive, others in the area stumbled onto the second site. Grady L. Barney Barnett was surveying the ranches for the suitability of irrigation. According to Vern Maltes, a close friend, Barnett found the remains of the disc. Maltes never asked about the craft because Barnett told him about the occupants. Small men. Four or five feet tall. It is kind of funny that the way they say it. I don't think I would ask about the craft either if you tell me about the man. Maltes never asked about the craft because Barnett told him about the occupants. Small men, 4 or 5 feet tall, thin, with big heads. They were lying outside the craft. While Barnett was standing there, close enough to touch the bodies, a group of students and archaeologists arrived. They too saw the bodies and the strange craft. I skipped over it, but they interviewed the archaeologists. Army arrived at the second crash and was horrified to find civilians there already. The civilians were rounded up and told that they had stumbled upon something that had national security aspects. They were never to mention what they had seen. The officer in charge told them that the government would be able to find them if they talked. And remember, I read to you a few weeks back the law in the federal code that most people never heard of, giving absolute unilateral and total authority to quarantine indefinite those exposed to extraterrestrial matter. The officer in charge told them that the government would be able to find them if they talked. They were escorted off the site as the army moved in and began to cover the bodies. Robert Shirky, standing in the operations building, watched as MPs began carrying wreckage through to load onto a C-54 of the 1st Air Transport Unit. To see better, Robert Shirky had to step around Colonel Blanchard. Pappy Henderson, Captain O.W. Henderson, then took the material to Wright Field in Ohio.
This is the end of Side 1. Side 2. Thank you.